The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, the Irish in the resistance during World War II.
She was what was that revered thing in France. She was a resistante from the very, very beginning of the war. We were surprised to find evidence that she was operating in at least five different networks.
The previously untold stories of Irish people who took a stand against Nazi occupation in Europe. Also, a look back at 9/11 from a unique perspective.
The president was wanting to get back to Washington, D.C., but the rest of the White House were wanting him to delay.
We'll hear an account from Colonel Mark Tillman, who was the pilot of Air Force One that fateful day. Plus, John Steinbeck's pilgrimage to Ireland.
The place seemed to have played quite an important part in his background and his growing up. And I think it's the sort of typically Irish storytelling connection that he picked up on.
How the famous author drew inspiration from his grandfather, Samuel Hamilton, a native of County Derry. But we begin this evening with World War II. In occupied Europe during the conflict, countless acts of courage took place in the shadows, where ordinary people risked everything to resist against Nazi tyranny. Among them were many Irish women and men who joined resistance networks across the continent. Their stories, long overlooked, are now being brought to light in a new book called The Irish in the Resistance, The Untold Stories of the Ordinary Heroes Who Resisted Hitler. The book reveals the lives of these individuals who worked to secure freedom for others. The authors are Clodagh Finn and John Morgan, who join me now in studio. You're both very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
John, this book, I think for you, is the culmination of a pretty long journey researching these stories. Tell me about the woman you met while on a trip to the Pyrenees on the French-Spanish border back in 2009.
Yes, Miles, I was interested in history and particularly of World War II, and I had come across a term which I hadn't been familiar with, which was escape lines. From there, I discovered there was a group in England called the Escape Lines Memorial Society who effectively take history out of the books, and you strap on your hiking boots and take to the Pyrenees to follow the routes that the escape lines used to smuggle so many people across the Pyrenees, for example. And so around 2009, I was down there for the weekend. I was taking part in the commemorative hike, and I knew of the quite famous Nadine Dumont, who was a former member of the Belgian Resistance and specifically of Comet. And to my surprise, I was told she'd like to talk to me. Couldn't really understand why, but of course it wasn't me, it was the fact that I was Irish. And she wanted to talk to me about what she described as her friend, Catherine Crean. Catherine had lived in Brussels during the war. She had been involved with an intelligence network and later became involved with Comet, where she helped in various ways. She brought books and met with evaders, naturally most of whom were English speaking, and so that made them feel slightly more at home in very difficult circumstances. She taught some of the safe housekeepers English so that they could converse with those that they were sheltering. And as happened to Nadine, sadly, Catherine was arrested and later deported to Ravensbrück concentration camp. And the story that Nadine particularly wanted to share with me was a very sad one, insofar as later on in the war, she had been much younger than Catherine. Nadine was approximately 20 or so. Catherine was in her 60s. And Nadine described effectively slave labour conditions in the camp. And she arrived back, and even as a young woman in her 20s, exhausted after the day's work. And as she more or less slumped onto her mattress in the barracks, she heard a voice beside her, and she looked and saw that it was her friend Catherine, who was clearly extremely weak, very weak indeed, and possibly as approaching death. And she said that Catherine, who had beautiful red hair, said to her, would she comb her hair or set her hair? It was just look, she was looking for a simple bit of human comfort. And Nadine said to me, I tried to help. She said, I helped a little, but I literally was so exhausted, I could virtually not lift my hand. And I remember the word she used, Miles. She said, I couldn't even do that much for her. Mm. And at that moment, she broke down in tears. And the pain was as raw 70 odd years later, or nearly 70 years later, as it had been all those years later she had brought me back to revisit. that was the beginning for me. I had never heard of a Catherine Crean. As I said, I knew little about the escape lines, but was fascinated by them. And I just wondered how many other Catherine Creans are out there. And that began a journey from then to now.
Let's stick with Catherine Crean for the moment, because there are, as it turns out, many Catherine Creans out there. One of the interesting things about this book is that, unlike lots of elements and aspects of Irish history, it represents women very, very well. You went seeking information on Catherine Crean. Not easy to find.
Not easy to find, Miles. We pulled information together from various categories, but I think it is true to say that there was and is very little about her. And I think that's probably one of the things we hope for the book, that it will create a conversation and maybe we'll find out more about her and others. But Catherine was born on Moore Street, 8 Moore Street, in December 1879. So it was unusual in terms of her age when she was in the resistance all those years later. Her father was John Crean. He was an engine fitter. Her mother was Ellen Nee Doran, and she grew up on Moore Street at some point, late 20s possibly, based on the dates we can isolate. She made her way to Brussels. Emigration is nothing new in Ireland, but it was a less well-trodden path. She found herself in Brussels and she worked ultimately as a governess, a live-in governess with an aristocratic family, a Baron Edouard and his wife Gilaine Empin, which the address, Catherine's address during the war was 1 Rue Zinner, which is quite an upmarket part of Brussels. And as far as I know, it's now part of the American Embassy compound. She clearly felt a debt to her adopted country. She got involved with an intelligence network first called the Luke Network. She then got involved with Comet. And as I said earlier, she would help to bring provisions and help out in various ways.
And Comet was responsible for attempting to repatriate prisoners or
yes,
ex-prisoners or escape prisoners or pilots or whatever.
Predominantly Allied airmen,
right.
Miles, that Comet created in Belgium, and the escape line travelled all the way down through France and across the Western or Basque Pyrenees. So different people worked in different parts of that line, and so her part was up in the northern section, and so she helped the evaders. Nadine also humorously told me on one occasion, she said, my geography as a 19-year-old wasn't good in terms of Britain and Ireland, and she said, I just assumed that anybody living in the British Isles was British or English. And she said, I introduced her on one occasion and I said, this is Catherine, she's English. And Nadine says that Catherine then drew herself up to her greatest height, small and all as she was, and said, I am not English, I am Irish. So she was very proud of where she came from.
And she came close to surviving. She died of dysentery in April 1945, so only a few months away from being rescued, basically.
That's correct, Miles, and that's the most heartbreaking part of it, is that it virtually 3 to 4 weeks before the camp would be liberated, she just didn't make it. She died within weeks of liberation.
And astonishingly, Nadine is still with us.
Nadine, thankfully, is still with us, went on to have a wonderful long life, and early September 2024, she celebrated her 102nd birthday.
Now, Clodagh, you met John while researching a woman called Mary Elms, another woman who was involved in the resistance, who helped Jews and refugees escape the collaborationist Vichy authorities in France. And you found a common interest, and this began joint research into Catherine Crean and into others.
That's right. I came across Mary Elms in 2016. And at the time, she was another unknown name, very well known in France. And also she was awarded the Righteous Among the Nations. So she is honoured by Israel as being somebody who has saved people from Nazis in wartime France, but she wasn't known here. And she was working in Rivesaltes, which is in the southwest France. And she was working for the Quakers. And she was there in 1942. And she saw that children were slated to go on the cattle wagons to be taken first to Drancy in Paris and then on to their ultimate death in Auschwitz. And she spirited them away. That actual line exists on a pencil written note. It's astounding what remains. And the more I researched, I found that she and her colleagues who were working for the American Quakers, they saved between them 427 children that we know of. Like so many others, she was arrested. She was brought to Gestapo notice. She was in jail for 6 months and was released. And like so many others, even when they came up against danger and were caught, once they were released, they went right back to work. And I wondered, because she was operating in Perpignan, I knew of the escape lines, that there were these places that went over the Pyrenees. So that's how I got in touch with John. And he started to tell me the stories of other names he knew. And we started to think, how many Irish people were involved in this resistance activity, first in France and then in Europe in general? And we started slowly to put together the names of the people who were involved. We had great help from David Murphy, the historian in Maynooth. He wrote a groundbreaking chapter about 20 years ago and he listed a lot of the names. So we started trawling in archives, actually using social media, would you believe, to find relatives, which we did, and just kind of looking for information in old books, in memoirs, anywhere at all we could find. And the final tally is 59 in the book. And one of the things John said was, one of the things we hoped would happen when the book came out is that we would discover others. No sooner was the book published last week than this woman told me of a woman from West Cork who was operating in Angers, and she was gathering intelligence and she saved a lot of people from arrest and execution. She was working in the town hall. So now we have a grand total of 60, but we're sure there's so many others.
Now, you're a proud Kerry woman and you start the book with the story of Janie McCarthy, who I'm sure was equally proud of being a Kerry woman.
She certainly was. And I had heard of Janie McCarthy, and that's a testament to the people of Killarney who kept her memory alive. And I suppose the focus on the book is on those that are lesser known. But when we started to look at Janie McCarthy, she had to feature very prominently in the book, because she was what was that kind of revered thing in France. She was a resistante from the very, very beginning of the war. We were surprised to find evidence that she was operating in at least five different networks. She spoke about the war, so we have her own testimony, and she gave interviews to the Kerryman. But what was amazing, as we started to look at the files and the post-war testimonies of Allied airmen and other soldiers who had survived, she appears in at least 10 of them, and some of them very early on. I suppose a lot of the people who were involved in the resistance were involved in two key activities, the kind of slow plodding work of intelligence gathering. And she's very prominent in that in the beginning of the war. From the get-go, a friend of hers actually hears Charles de Gaulle's famous speech from London, which he makes in June 1940. He gives this rallying cry saying, "The spark of the resistance must not be extinguished." And Janie McCarthy's friend heard that. And immediately she started to see, what can we do? And the first thing they did was they gathered intelligence. They went on a train up towards Sherbrooke to try and get information on enemy installations. And Janie was right to the fore of that. Initially, the information was sent back to London by carrier pigeon. And then we see they were actually decorated in the war, the carrier pigeons. Mm-hmm. They did such sterling work. And then you see from the files that actually the network gets a radio, is dropped into France. And you see too very early on that the networks are infiltrated and broken. And you can see, it seems from the American intelligence documents, that Janie McCarthy's tiny flat, a chambre de bonne or a maid's room under the eaves of number 64 Rue Sainte-Anne, was a rendezvous place. It says, there's a line in it says that they would regroup there whenever a network was broken. So she went essentially from intelligence gathering, and then as the war progressed and America came into the war, we see her turn turning up in the testimonies of airmen who said, Mrs. McCarthy kept us laughing all the time.
And the Germans were pretty sure that she was involved, weren't they? I mean, she was arrested, I think, a couple of
times.
She
was not arrested.
Oh, she wasn't arrested.
She escaped arrest, but her friend and the linchpin of the organisation was arrested. And she very narrowly escaped arrest herself in 1943. She was going to dinner in Madame Barbier's flat, a place she had been several times before. She had brought airmen there through the metro, pretending they were deaf and dumb. And a student, she was still teaching English, this is what her profession was, called, and she was delayed. And by the time she got there, she found that Madame Barbier had been arrested. And just a little vignette, which will give you an idea of how resilient and selfless those people were. When the Gestapo arrived at Madame Barbier's flat, the phone rang, and one of the German soldiers picked it up and he said, "This is the doctor. You must come immediately to Madame Barbier's." And Madame Barbier started to scream so that the person on the other end of the line would be alerted that this was not in fact the doctor. And they beat her. And Madame Barbier was held in she said she had 25 hard interrogations. The blood would run cold, just wondering what that was. And she was held in solitary confinement. But Janie McCarthy was not arrested, but she did get spooked. And in 1944, when she was in even another resistance network, she went into hiding for a while.
But she did make it back. She made it home, back to Kerry, didn't she?
Well, she stayed in France because France, by the time the war broke out, she'd already been in France from about 1910. She was decorated in France as an educator ever before the war. She got the Palme Académique, which is a distinction to people who give services to educators. She did come back every year and proudly wore her medals and spoke of what she had done. So you
did an interview with the Kerry man.
She did indeed. And what's interesting in that, it was in 1954, and the Kerryman had, "Here are all our heroes who've done well abroad, and there are 100 men and one woman, the indomitable Janie McCarthy."
Now, John, a lot of the Irish who were involved in undercover activities against the Nazis came through something called the Special Operations Executive, which is a pretty innocuous name for a far from innocuous force.
Yes, we had, Miles, some of the Irish certainly were involved with the SOE. And the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, was set up by Churchill in 1940. And its role really was espionage and sabotage in Nazi-occupied Europe, but critically also to assist and support local resistance groups. So be that in terms of arms, be that in terms of provisions, be that in terms of training, be that in terms of the provision of radio operators and couriers, etc. So, yes, Irish people certainly were involved in those activities.
One of whom was a woman called Maureen O'Sullivan. Tell me about her experience.
Maureen O'Sullivan is Hollywood worthy. When you read about it, you know,
she's
wonder,
not the Hollywood actress.
She's
Maureen
not.
O'Sullivan.
She's Maureen. Okay. Patricia O'Sullivan, or Maureen Paddy O'Sullivan, as she was known. Because when she joined the SOE, I suppose rather unimaginatively, when there was an Irish person, they called them Paddy. And Maureen was born in Rathmines, Charleville Road, just to give a shout out to the local connection. She went to live with an aunt in Belgium, and she also studied at the Rathmines College of Commerce. And I mentioned Belgium because she would have been bilingual. And I think a lot of the people who were successful in the resistance, they were very good linguists. It was really important to be able to pass as a French person. So when Maureen, first of all, when the war broke out, she was training to be a nurse. And then she was called up. She wanted to volunteer, and she was called up for the SOE in 1943, and she parachuted into France in 1944. And the description, which is in her file of how she landed, is what makes this quite filmic, if you like. So she parachuted in thick fog into occupied France, and she landed near Limoges. And as she landed with such force that she knocked herself out. And she was out for a little while. She thought actually she'd seen her last days. And then suddenly she came to and she could feel breathing on her face. And she said, "Oh no, I have been rumbled." And she woke to find a curious cow looking at her. you know. And if that sounded like a bad start, it went from bad to worse because she wasn't where she was supposed to be. Luckily, she went in the right direction and she came across members of the fireman circuit, which was an information intelligence gathering circuit, and they were also involved in sabotage. And they took one look at Paddy and they were horrified that London had sent them a woman. They weren't expecting a woman. But their entire arsenal consisted of two revolvers. So when they saw that she had landed with lots of ammunition and 22 containers, they were happy enough. And they brought her to a safe house. But when the leader of firemen, Major Teddy Mayer, saw her, he was also disgusted. He said, this is not woman's work. But more than that, she had blonde hair and blue eyes, and he said she doesn't look the part. And bear in mind, the SOE took extraordinary measures to try to get people to fit in. In wartime France, even the way a button was sewn in could actually give you away, because we're so used to the high street now and everything being uniform. But in wartime France, the French would sew buttons in with parallel stitching, but the English would sew them in it with a cross. So a simple thing like that. So when he saw his blonde radio operator, he was disgusted. And more than that, she couldn't ride a bicycle, which was crucial in wartime France. But within 6 weeks, when London said, we'll send you two men, that was a mistake, he said, no, having trained her, I will keep her. And she went on to be one of the most successful radio operators in the field. And she stayed in the terrain for 7 months, when the life expectancy of a radio operator was just 6 weeks. And one little thing, she spoke about her courier. She had a French courier who was a teenage boy. She wasn't captured, but he was, and he was tortured, and he didn't make it out, and he never gave them away. So she was nearly arrested a few times, but it just shows the resilience of the people in the field.
And happily she did, unlike Catherine Crean, she did survive.
She did survive and was decorated. She got an MBE for her work.
John, you also write about a man called Conall O'Donnell, who operated in Greece in 1943. I suppose to some extent his claim to fame was that he was caught up in the aftermath of one of the worst Nazi atrocities of the war. Tell me about O'Donnell.
Yeah, Conall was from Gortin in County Sligo, Miles. He was a captain in the Royal Engineers and then attached to the SOE, who sent him to Greece in October 1943. And the purpose of going to Greece was his job was to find suitable locations and construct airstrips so that provisions, again, to support the Greek resistance could be landed and help could be given that way. But you're right, I guess the one event that possibly defined his time there happened very, very shortly afterwards. In fact, on the 13th of December, the Greek partisans had been successful in some attacks on German soldiers. And the Germans made it clear that they were going to wreak terrible revenge. And they chose the town of Kalavirta, which would be in the southern part of Greece, in a mountainous area. It's approximately 200 kilometres west of Athens. And on the 13th of December, the Germans entered the town, isolated all of the male population over 12 years of age, took them outside the town and killed them all. 460, 470 plus people killed. The women were rounded up, they were locked up, and then the Germans destroyed the rest of the town. Conall had been with the partisans at the time, some distance away, but they in fact heard some of the gunshots. And when they went later at a safe time to visit the town, they found an absolutely awful scene of carnage. After the war, Conall had said that the screams of the people in the towns were unforgettable, an awful experience that he remembered for the rest of his life. He reported back to his superiors, and I don't think this was particularly or made him particularly popular, but he said, for the moment, I want you to prioritise aid to the town more than arms to the resistance. Aid for Kalavirta is more important right now. It was December, after all, in a mountainous area. They were in winter and a tougher part of winter was to come, and they had nothing. And his concern at that point was to help the people of Kalavirta.
He didn't just have to contend with the Nazis, so he also had to contend with communist partisans.
Yes, so he then stayed until June 1944, Miles, when he was withdrawn. He was physically suffering at that stage from the privations of the time. He had spent literally living on the land. But he went back in September 1944 as part of the operation to retake Greece. And you're right, he was then arrested, imprisoned for a time by Greek communist forces. Yes, so he saw that experience too.
He never forgot Kalaverta. Talked about it, or didn't talk about it very much, but he never forgot it.
He'd never forgot it. And as I said, I think it was the event that defined his time there. Certainly after the war, Miles, he had suffered post-war nightmares. He certainly felt that the massacre at Kalaverta really needed to be more well known than it was. He talked about Oradour Sorglan, and that was, of course, a terrible massacre. It would have received more attention, and he felt that Kalaverta equally deserved that. But when he died in 1996, his family found that actually on the anniversary of the massacre, 13th of December, every year, he paid for a mass to be said for the people of Kalaverta.
We've just talked about a very, very small number of the 59 stories. Well, you've added another one now, a 60th, when the new edition when it
That's
comes
it.
Out. Number 60, and I'm sure you'll have more by then as well. The book is called The Irish in the Resistance, The Untold Stories of the Ordinary Heroes Who Resisted Hitler. It's published by Gill Books. The authors are my guests, Clodagh Finn and John Morgan. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening. And after the break, we'll hear a unique perspective on the events of 9/11 as Colm Flynn speaks to Colonel Mark Tillman, the pilot of Air Force One on that fateful day. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. Now, this is more recent history than we usually cover on this programme, but the events of September 11th, 2001 have in so many ways shaped the world we live in today. And of course, this week saw the 23rd anniversary of that tragic day. We're going to look back on the events of 9/11 from a unique perspective. Colm Flynn brings us this account from President George Bush's personal pilot, who was on board Air Force One.
Air Force One, fly runway heading, maintain 12,000, cleared for takeoff.
I arrived at the plane 2 hours prior to takeoff, so around 8:30. So after talking with security out front, talking with the crew chiefs, I walked up the stairs, went into the nose of the aircraft.
Colonel Mark Tillman was the captain of Air Force One. And on the morning of September the 11th, the plane was sitting on the tarmac at Sarasota Airport in Florida. Meanwhile, in New York, an unthinkable tragedy was unfolding.
What the hell was that?
It sounded like a plane crash.
The first attack was at 8:46. So at 8:46, all of a sudden, I'm in the president's quarters, just looking around, talking with the flight attendant.
From NBC News, this is Today.
I have got to interrupt you right now.
Sorry.
We want to go live right now and show you a picture of the World Trade Center.
And that's when I went upstairs and saw, you know, at this point, the Today Show and all the morning shows were showing the first tower had been hit by, as they call it, a light aircraft.
This just in,
Matt,
we're looking at
we have a breaking news story to tell you about.
And within just a few minutes, every news network in the U.S. started relaying the live pictures of the World Trade Center and around the world, too.
So the major story breaking from New York, Neil O'Dowd is editor of the Irish Vice. Neil, good afternoon. What's happening? It's the World Trade Center.
It was obvious to those of us watching the TV upstairs that it wasn't a light aircraft. You know, the imprint in the tower was way too large for a light aircraft.
What was your first initial instinctual reaction?
Basically pilot air or something like that.
Really exciting for me to be here.
Just a few miles from Air Force One, President George W. Bush was sitting in an elementary school, joining the children for their morning lesson.
What do these two letters say?
R. Yes, R. The president had an education campaign, No Child Left Behind, and he was meeting with school teachers.
I want to thank Ms. Daniels for being a teacher.
As President Bush sat there in that Florida classroom, back in New York, things were going from bad to worse.
Just hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Exploded.
Oh my God.
When you saw the second plane go in, what did you think?
By the time the second plane had gone in, everything had come together at that point. The FAA had given information. They talked about all the different planes that were being hijacked, and all this information was flowing into us. So by the time the second plane hit the tower, we knew the country was under attack at that point. And at that point, the decision was made to do like we always do for the continuity of government, relocate people, relocate the President of the United States. Highly classified plan, never been done before, but it was time to go ahead and execute it.
President Bush's motorcade skidded as it turned to pull up in front of Air Force One, and watching from out of the cockpit was Captain Tillman. He now had one of the most important jobs in the world, getting the US president to safety to ensure the continuity of government.
The engines on the right side were running when the president came to the aircraft. The moment he hit the bottom stair of the staircase, I started the left engine. So by the time he got to the top of the stairs, back door had been closed. As the stair truck was moving away, the engines on the left side had spooled up. So we were ready to move at that point.
Air Force One, fly runway heading, maintain 12,000, cleared for takeoff.
Air Force One accelerated at full speed down the runway and took off with a sharp climb into the sky. Captain Tillman had the plane in the air even before he knew where he was meant to fly. And as every commercial plane in the United States was ordered to land at the nearest airport and air traffic controllers were overwhelmed, there was chaos and confusion in the air.
Do we know that the path's going to be cleared to Washington, D.C.? Is Washington, D.C. going to be cleared? Do I take them to Andrews Air Force Base? Maybe we should take them to another base first, kind of unannounced, to see what's going to happen. Have a decoy, have our backup aircraft. These are all things that I put in motion. But the other side of it is you don't want to confuse and add more fog to the war by having a separate Air Force One show up and they think the president's coming in and whatever.
Air Force One, when you're rolling, if you look
to add to the confusion and frustration, as the phone networks were being jammed, most of the communication on Air Force One started to fail, making it hard for the president to talk to other members of government.
There was a period of time where we went from 40-some phone lines down to two. A young radio operator, when we lost all the communication, said, "Hey, sir, from my old job, I still remember the codes for all the satellites for that job and whatever. Do you want me to pull those satellites in? We might get in trouble for it." "We'll never get in trouble, son. Go for it and make it happen." He gave us five satellites immediately. So, these are the kind of people that are driven to make things happen, do the right things to protect the United States of America.
Bouncing the president's phone calls off secret military satellites 22,000 miles in space became their only option. As they continued to fly, air traffic control contacted Air Force One with a chilling warning. A commercial plane was descending and flying towards them, and the plane was not responding to air traffic control, similar to the others that had already been hijacked.
The FAA let us know that the plane transponder was off, was not talking to the controllers, was descending into us. And at that point, it was, once again, big sky theory. Shortly after we learned where the aircraft was high and to the right, all I did was ask to turn back out towards the Gulf of Mexico.
Mark banked his plane away from where the other unidentified aircraft was coming from and increased his speed. Later, they learned that the pilots of that aircraft were not responding to air traffic control because they were busy talking to their airline, who were warning them to lock their cockpit. Mark flew out over the Gulf of Mexico to buy some time, because on board, there was an argument. The president wanted to return to the capital immediately, but others thought it was a bad idea.
The president was wanting to get back to Washington, D.C., but the rest of the White House, the vice president, Dr. Rice, et cetera, were wanting him to delay. Though when the president was told that, he countermanded the orders and said, "No, we're going back to Washington, D.C." That's all it took from me. The commander-in-chief, as a military man, I've got the commander-in-chief with me. So I hear it first, right from the man's mouth. My direction was to head to Washington, D.C. at the speed of heat, and we were going fast, heading back to Washington.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're looking at live pictures of the Pentagon where there is billowing smoke.
As they continued to get more news of the events of that horrific day, Air Force One turned in the sky again, and a decision was made not to go to the White House, but to land in an Air Force base in Louisiana.
Thanks very much. The whole side has collapsed.
The whole building has collapsed.
But Mark remembers the most chilling and surreal part of that flight was hearing the president giving clearance to fighter jets to shoot down passenger aircraft if they did not respond to orders from the fighter jets. And then they heard a plane was down in Pennsylvania.
I mean, we got information the plane was no longer on radar. It had crashed. The president asked and the vice president asked whether the military had shot it down. We were standing by trying to get that information. You know, all I was thinking in my head was, you know, I'm a good Christian, and that's all. I made a quick prayer to God. Hey, you know, let us get this information quick and let us rally and let us figure out exactly what has occurred. And, you know, and shortly after that, we got the word from the fighters saying, no, you know, they hadn't even come into position yet. They saw the airliner descending.
They were told that the fighter jets were just about to reach that plane and watched it go down. The passengers on board had fought back against the hijackers.
You know, and at that point, the president was asking if it looked like there were any, signs of life or whatever. And, you know, and eventually we got the word, no, it's there. We can't even see a sign of an aircraft. It's just a large hole in the ground.
Wow.
Everything changed at that point. We're trying to make sure we've figured out everything that's going to occur. And now it's time to get the president on the ground so we can talk with the American people so they know that he's actually still the president of the United States and that everything's being accomplished. And then it's time to get him home, make everything happen.
Eventually that evening, Colonel Mark Tillman was able to fly the president safely back to Washington, D.C., just in time for him to address the nation from the Oval Office.
Good evening. Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack. Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil, despicable acts of terror.
3 days later, Mark flew President George Bush over Manhattan and then went with him to meet the first responders at Ground Zero.
Yeah, and it was the same kind of day as September 11th. It was beautiful skies, clear in a million. You could see everything. I went ahead and went over Ground Zero, banked it up on the side of the plane where the president's quarters were so he could see it, roughly 1,000 feet in the air, and you could see everything. You could see the towers were down. That image is still in my mind, you know, devastated.
I want you all to know that America today...
And then when the president on that day made his speech on Ground Zero, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but here's a guy they gave a megaphone to, the President of the United States, where the firefighters are yelling, "We can't hear you." And he comes back, "Well, I hear you.
I can hear you." I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people...
You know, you could just see everybody coming alive. It was just, you know, we were down, but there was no way they're going to keep us down. You know, that brings tears to my eyes. What America was like back in those days.
Air Force One, contact Indy Center. One.
How we all came together.
Air Force One, 13342. Thanks very much. Good day.
And that was Colonel Mark Tillman ending that report from Colm Flynn on what happened on board Air Force One on September 11th, 2001. After the break, we'll be hearing about author John Steinbeck's roots in County Derry. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. The celebrated American writer John Steinbeck, known for his classic literary works like The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men, and East of Eden, once visited a quiet corner of County Derry, seeking to reconnect with his Irish heritage. Our reporter, Mark McMenamin, has the story.
Every Irishman, and that means anyone with one drop of Irish blood, sooner or later makes a pilgrimage to the home of his ancestors. I am half Irish, the rest of my blood being watered down with German and Massachusetts English. But Irish blood doesn't water down very well. The strain must be very strong.
The place seemed to have played quite an important part, this area, in his background and his growing up. He particularly relates to his grandfather, and I think it's the sort of typically Irish storytelling connection that he picked up on.
It's not that he ignores his German and Massachusetts roots, but he identifies with his Irish roots. And if you look at the way he writes, there is a quality of it. He identifies with the underdog.
In 1952, the great American author John Steinbeck travelled to a small rural parish outside Ballykelly, County Derry, to explore his Irish roots. This is local historian Dougie Bartlett.
In fact, he does say that his passion and his love of literature and so on came from the Hamilton side of the family. He had quite a selection of ancestors if he'd wanted to go down the direction. He had German and English and Massachusetts and no want of characters, but he seemed to focus on the Irish aspect.
Steinbeck had just published his magnum opus, East of Eden, a semi-biographical epic loosely based on his own family history. One of the principal characters shared the name of his grandfather, Samuel Hamilton, a native of Ballykelly, who Steinbeck remembered as a child.
My grandfather was a really great man, a man of sweet speech and sweet courtesy. He died when I was quite young, but it is remarkable how much I remember about him.
Although Steinbeck wasn't very old when the grandfather died, he said he had great commerce with him, great conversation with him, had spent a lot of time with him, had obviously picked up on some senses of him that being exaggerated further through the memories of his grandfather brought about by his mother or through the stories or whatever.
Samuel Hamilton had emigrated to the United States after the famine, eventually making his way to California. Steinbeck had always been apprehensive about visiting Derry, lest the myth that he had built up in his head about his grandfather, being almost larger than life, failed to live up to his expectations.
He had always panicked a wee bit about going back to the ancestors, because he had built up in his head this wonderful image of his grandfather and thought his grandfather was, that there was a bit of illegality about him, there was a bit of spirit about him, he had a lust for life and great fun. And the image that he got of the hospitality in Derry was bizarrely quite different.
This is historian and author Brian Drummond.
He arrived on a Sunday and the town was locked down. He couldn't get a drink. And he even bartered with his hotel manager to try and get a bottle of whiskey, and it was not forthcoming. So he took it to be a very dour place and a very dour town. But the following day, he makes a connection with a taxi driver, and he starts looking for the original farm place, which is kind of unfortunate. There's a sadness to this here, because he missed his last surviving ancestor by 2 years, who was one of the last Hamiltons in the area. So when he calls to look for his roots, he ends up essentially looking at graveyards.
Steinbeck found the old Hamilton homestead intact with new owners, but they didn't remember his grandfather. Eventually, he made his way to the local graveyard, where the sexton, or caretaker, showed him the final resting place of his ancestors. Dougie Bartlett, local historian.
He was directed to a caretaker of the Ballykelly Presbyterian Church, where Samuel Hamilton, his grandfather, had been baptised in the 1830s. So the graveyard's actually in Tamlachfinlagan Church, and there's a photograph actually of Steinbeck kneeling at that church.
According to Dougie, Steinbeck's sense of Irishness and the influence of the Hamilton side of his family is clear in his writing.
Steinbeck saw the story of Samuel Hamilton as the pioneer story, the typical American pioneer story, who goes out with nothing, crosses the country, and makes something of it, a meagre existence, but at the same time, an existence and something creative. And I think that's why the literature of Steinbeck still survives, because it does so typically show that group of people, that era, and all that there is with it.
When Steinbeck returned to America, after his visit to Derry, he wrote a piece for Collier's magazine, which expressed his feelings as he looked at the graves of his ancestors in Ballykelly. He recalled meeting the local sexton, who showed him where his relatives were buried. Among them were his great-uncle William and his cousin Elizabeth. Elizabeth had been known locally for her rose garden, where she spent a great deal of time cultivating flowers, a garden now overgrown and neglected. Steinbeck wrote,
"The rain was beginning to fall. The sexton left us for a moment and came back carrying a full-blown red rose. 'Would you like to have it?' he asked. I took it, and that's the seat of my culture and the origin of my being and the soil of my background, the one full-blown evidence of 1,000 years of family. I have pressed it in a book."
And that was Mark McMenamin reporting there on the story of John Steinbeck's ancestral pilgrimage to County Derry in 1952. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Pather Carney on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.